Chapter 43. Surprisingly, Bibwit Hare did not have a pair of gemstone fire crystals tucked anywhere in his scholar's robe. So they had to build a fire the old-fashioned way, with the suns and a pile of dead branches. The volcanic plains were behind them, and they had made camp next to a wide river, en route to the Valley of Mushrooms. Dodge wrapped a dampened leaf around Bibwit's burn and tied it with strong vine. Bibwit tested the movement of his arm, grimacing, and perhaps making more of his injury than was necessary, because Dodge, with a quick glance at General Doppelganger, said, "We might have to cut it off." Bibwit fell still, too horrified to speak. "You can tutor just as well with one arm as with two, can't you?" Bibwit's mouth opened and closed, but nothing came out. Dodge and General Doppelganger sputtered with laughter. "I'm just teasing, Bibwit," Dodge said. "You'll be fine."
"Oh, ha-ha," Bibwit said uneasily. "A bit of levity to ease the burden we're under. Yes, ha-ha-ha."
But he hugged his injured arm close until Dodge and the General settled into sleep. Regaining his usual composure, he took a seat next to the princess.
"Now, Alice, we shall have that lesson of ours that keeps getting put off. Lucky for us, I have memorized most of the necessary books."
Alice nodded, but she was in no mood for a lesson. The day itself had been a lesson, in survival.
"I will close my eyes for a moment," continued Bibwit, "to file through all that's in my head for the appropriate material. It'll just take a moment."
But as soon as the tutor shut his eyes, he began to snore, his ears opening and closing with each breath. Alice smiled a tired smile and pulled the ends of his robe about him as a blanket. She moved to the other side of the fire to let him sleep undisturbed. As it had long ago on that first night with Quigley and the orphans in the London alley, her mind was plagued too much to allow her any rest.
"How did it work when I was young?"
Her ability to conjure objects from the strength and depth of her imagination.
"How had it worked?"
She'd been lucky with the muzzle. She hadn't intended to conjure such a thing, had only tried to imagine Dodge safely out of the spider's sticky clutches. Hatter sat beyond the fire's glow cleaning his weapons, his top hat beside him. He removed first his left wrist bracelet and then his right, and set about wiping their blades with a leaf. Alice had never seen a milliner without his bracelets.
"He looks so much like an ordinary Wonderlander."
Indeed, especially now, as Hatter paused in his work to strip off his long outer coat and lay it on the ground beside him. Without his coat and the telltale weapons, there was nothing in his appearance to distinguish him from any normal adult male Wonderlander.
"He must have hopes, dreams, loves and sorrows outside his duty, as anyone does. Strange that I should know so little about him, when he's devoted his life to protecting my family."
He caught her looking at him. She smiled in apology, as if she had been intruding. Hatter went back to his cleaning.
"The thing about when she was young, she didn't remember her imagination having to work. It just was. Hatter?"
"Yes, Princess?"
"When you're fighting in a battle, what do you think about?"
Hatter considered.
"Nothing, Princess. Nothing at all."
"So you don't tell yourself, 'I'm going to throw my top hat, and then I'm going to attack with the blades on my wrists,' or anything of that sort?"
"No."
"No," Alice echoed. "Of course not. It just happens. Your body knows what to do."
Hatter nodded.
"It's unconscious. To will something into being, the willing of it must be so deep down that no self-doubt is possible. The imaginative power itself must be a given, a thing already proven that cannot be disbelieved.
Lunar hours passed, and at first Alice was all too aware of her efforts to conjure, all too aware of the items she attempted to imagine into being.
A platter, a sword, a crown. A platter, a sword, a crown.
She repeated these words over and over again to herself. No crown materialized. Part of a platter did form, but quickly vanished. A sword appeared, but in outline only, plain and without detail, as if the weapon had not been precisely envisioned. With time, the fire died down to a heap of glowing embers. Alice's mind cleared. While she was in this trance-like state, a large glass cover akin to one you might see over a cake in a bakery formed in the air. Alice looked at it without surprise. She tilted her head to the left, and the glass cover tilted left. She tilted her head to the right, and the cover tilted right. Then, without moving at all, she brought it down over the fire. Robbed of oxygen, the embers fizzled out. The glass cover dissolved in the air. Alice beamed, for not only had she conjured, but she had controlled her imagination in a way she never had before.
I'll need to practice. I'll need to... Oh!
Hatter was watching her, had witnessed this first controlled exercise of her powerful imagination. He bowed his head in respect. Then came a final honking snore, and Bibwit awoke, shivering and hugging himself.
It is chilly without the fire, isn't it?
Chapter 44. With the Queendom's looking-glasses obliterated, Red again turned her anger on Jack of Diamonds.
I grant you a leniency that others don't enjoy. Why? Because it's supposed to benefit me. I let you believe you're your own boss. In exchange, you're to provide me with Elysian intelligence. As queen, I command the better end of all deals. And it doesn't fill me with glee, Lord Diamond, that you've been profiting from treachery.
Your imperial...
Red made a shooting motion with her hand, and Jack slammed against a wall of the observation dome. The cat's tail whisked back and forth, happy and playful.
What am I to do with you?
Red asked.
Maybe you could...
Jack began. The cat raised a paw.
I know. It was a rhetorical question, fools. You don't answer it. Since when do I need help making anyone suffer?
This time the cat and Jack of Diamonds knew better than to answer. Red stepped up to Jack and stroked his wig. She held one of its long curls in her palm, studying it a moment. With sudden ferocity, she yanked the curl from the wig and tossed it away from her. The lock of hair lay on the floor, growing in size and hairiness. It grew and grew, developing arms and legs until it stood at twice Jack's height.
Lord Diamond, say hello to my beast of a wig,
Red yawned. Before Jack could offer a greeting, the beast dealt him a stinging blow to the stomach. He bent over, straining for air. The wig beast picked him up and tossed him across the room. He landed with a thud worthy of his girth, and with a single bound the wig beast was beside him, lifting him to his feet, holding him upright with one wiggy limb, and slapping him with the other. The cat purred, a wide grin on his face as he watched Jack of Diamonds suffer. But his enjoyment was interrupted by the sharp-as-a-claw piercing of Red's voice, raised in anger and disbelief. Red had turned her imagination's eye on Alice. She should have seen nothing. Alice should have been part of the void. But instead she saw the princess, Hatter Madigan and the others, walking through the charred and molten landscape of the volcanic plains.
Not dead, she screeched. Alice, not dead.
Jack heard the words too, but it took a moment for his addled brain to understand their meaning. Between slugs from the Wigbeast, he managed to say,
They're going to Looking Glass Maze.
Red held up a hand and the Wigbeast halted.
I must be getting soft, Lord Diamond, if I think you could have said anything worth listening to.
It was lucky for Jack that Red had shrugged off the lessons Bibwit tried to teach her in adolescence. Jack was quick to understand that his knowledge of the Looking Glass Maze could save his life. But he would tell her as little as necessary. His future health and safety might depend on his leaking such valuable intelligence to Red.
The Looking Glass Maze, your imperial viciousness. By passing through the maze, Alice will reach her full potential of strength and imaginative power, and be able to defeat you.
But I have the heart crystal. She can't reach her full potential without that.
I'm only repeating what I heard from Bibwit Hare, your imperial viciousness.
He shouldn't have mentioned Bibwit. Red bristled. Jack cast a quick glance at the Wigbeast. It was perfectly still, as if it had never been alive. So far, so good.
What if I pass through the maze instead of her? Red asked.
Ah, very clever, your imperial viciousness. If you pass through the maze, then you'll be that much more powerful. I'm sure Alice won't be able to defeat you then.
What Jack of Diamonds knew of the Looking Glass Maze could fit in a Gwynnook's third nostril, which was very little. As a boy, he'd often heard his mother recall in bitter tones how Princess Genevieve had passed through the maze to become queen. But she didn't know that becoming queen was not just a matter of navigating the maze. None of the Diamond Clan had been tutored by Bibwit Hare, so none of them knew that only the person for whom the Looking Glass Maze was intended could enter it. But like many young men who grow up as privileged as Jack of Diamonds, he didn't suspect his own ignorance.
"We'll see if what you say is true," Red said. "Bring me in Queendom Sparamus."
The walrus toddled into the dome.
"Here it is, your imperial viciousness, in Queendom!"
The book flew from his flippers, hovered in the air before Red as she thumbed through its pages, searching for mention of the Looking-Glass Maze. She found none. She saw pages torn from the book and her own words in Bibwit's handwriting.
Bah!
She swatted the book and it flew at the walrus, but the waddly fellow ducked and the book hit the floor and skidded out the dome and down the hall.
I'll get it, your imperial viciousness, said the walrus butler,
and hurried after the book, never able to leave Red's company fast enough. Red strolled up to Jack, all the more frightening for her nonchalance.
And now, my unworthy servant, you are going to tell me where the Looking Glass Maze is.
But I don't know where it is.
Red's fingers twitched, and Jack thought he saw the Wigbeast move.
The Elysians don't know either, he said quickly. The caterpillars have to tell them.
The caterpillars! Those annoying, oversized larvae!
Red had tried to do away with them and their outdated prophesying when she first took control of the queendom. She didn't need those things breeding dissent with their predictions. But every time she tried to attack them, they saw her coming and vanished like smoke. So she had exercised her rage on their beloved Valley of Mushrooms. But what to do now? A raid on the valley would not serve her purpose.
I have decided to let Alice meet with the caterpillars, she announced. We'll maintain close surveillance on that goody-goody little heart, and when she leads us to the looking-glass maze's location, we'll attack, and I will enter it myself. Cat, bait the seekers.
But what about Lord Diamond? The feline whined.
He may prove useful yet.
Jack gave Red's furry assassin a taunting little smile. The cat was to blame for his trouble, the bruises he felt forming all over his body. He would have to return the favour somehow.
I see you don't treasure your lives as much as I'd supposed, Cat, or you would have obeyed my order by now,
Red said. As the cat sulked off to bait the seekers, Red again focused her imagination's eye on Alice. How wonderfully cruel it was going to be! Miss Prissy Hart would serve as personal guide to the looking-glass maze, and thereby become the agent of her own downfall. How deliciously nasty! The cat could hear the seeker's frenzied screeching even before he reached the end of the corridor, shouldered open the heavy door, and stepped inside the chamber, carved out of Mount Isolation itself. It was impossible to hear his own footfalls or breathing, because the seeker's cries, like the sound of pain itself, were so loud. The chamber was dimly lit by faint glowing crystals embedded in the walls. Hundreds of cages hung from the ceiling, with several seekers in each of them. Red's bloodhounds, bred out of her distrust and paranoia, creatures with bird-of-prey bodies and the heads of blood-sucking insects. Walking up and down the chamber, the cat stopped beneath each cage to wave Alice's London wedding dress, a souvenir from his raid on the Elysian headquarters. He teased the seekers with its scent, and they pressed eager faces against the bars of their cages. The baiting complete, the cat flipped a lever in the floor, and a wall retracted. A wall that from the outside looked like part of the mountain. The cages fell open, and with wild shrieks, the seekers flew out into the night. On the hunt.
Chapter 45. The Elysians emerged from a small wood to find themselves on a mountain top. The valley of mushrooms spread out before them. The suns were setting on the distant horizon, their slanting rays shining down on the mushrooms nestled within a ring of twilight blue mountains. No two mushrooms were alike, their colours ranging from earthy pink to unearthly brown to nearly translucent. And with the play of the suns on their caps and the multi-hued shadows they cast on the valley floor, the Elysians were greeted with a sight of impressive kaleidoscopic brilliance. The colours of the valley were like the sprouting of renewed hope in the breasts of Alice and her friends, and for a moment it seemed unlikely that Red could survive their rebellion. They may have been few in number, but they were strong and determined. They believed. But this optimism lasted only a moment, because as they descended into the valley, they saw that it wasn't as beautiful as it might have been, indeed as it once was. Mushroom stalks showed the marks of the cut. Mushroom caps lay butchered on the ground. Prayer temples were blasted apart. In silence, Bibwit led the Elysians through the unexpected desecration to a clearing, where they came upon five giant caterpillars whose bodies were coiled beneath them as they smoked from the same ancient hookah. Each of them sat on a mushroom as distinct in colour as himself, red, orange, yellow, purple and green. The caterpillars showed no sign of surprise upon seeing the Elysians, had in fact been aware of their presence for some time.
"The Caterpillar Council,"
Bibwit informed the others, and then stepped forward to address the oracles.
"Wise ones, we are in need of your assistance. We..."
The orange caterpillar raised his frontmost right leg, as if to say, "Shush," and all the little legs behind it echoed the gesture.
"We know why you've come. What sort of oracles would we be if we didn't know that?"
said the yellow caterpillar. The hookah burbled, the purple caterpillar inhaling deeply. His eyes rolled up into the back of his head, and smoke streamed out his nostrils. Dodge and General Doppelganger exchanged an uncertain glance. Hatter stood at the ready, a hand at the brim of his top hat, his eyes scanning the surroundings for trouble.
"Oh, wise, all-seeing caterpillars," said Bibwit Hare, "we offer you our humility and respect, and hope that—"
"I'm having the weirdest sense of déjà vu right now," said the green caterpillar.
"Duh," said the yellow caterpillar. "Do you think just maybe that's because you predicted this?"
"Oh, yeah."
The caterpillar council tittered.
"We are saddened to see that even your home has suffered from Red's reign,"
Bibwit pressed on.
"Knowing who we are and why we've come, then you already know."
But here the caterpillars added their voices to his.
"That we come for the health of the queendom, to install the rightful queen on her throne, and end these years of brutal tyranny."
Being able to see the future, and or possible futures, didn't always make the caterpillars agreeable conversationalists.
"Have you brought us anything to munch?"
asked the orange caterpillar.
"Some tarty tarts, perhaps,"
the yellow caterpillar hoped.
"Well,"
Bibwit said, checking his robe, but finding no tarty tarts.
"I'll conjure a dozen tarty tarts. It'll be good practice."
Alice started to concentrate, to focus her imaginings, when a series of blue smoke rings floated overhead, coming from somewhere deep within the mushrooms.
"Blue has summoned Alice," the orange caterpillar said. "He will tell her everything she needs to know."
The council fell silent, puffing intently on the hookah, as if able to communicate with one another through it.
"Go on, Alice," said Bibwit Hare. "It's all right."
The princess followed the trail of smoke rings back through the mushrooms to a ruined temple. Over its front door were the words, "Did Lao Tzu dream the butterfly, or did the butterfly dream Lao Tzu?" Sitting on a blue mushroom out front was the blue caterpillar, smoking from a hookah of his own.
"Thank you for seeing me,"
Alice said with a bow. The caterpillar grumbled, exhaling a cloud of smoke, in the middle of which Prince Leopold appeared. The prince was in a London drawing room, pacing anxiously back and forth, while his mother, Queen Victoria, sat fanning herself in a quilted chair. Dean and Mrs. Liddell were there too, sitting close together on a settee. Prim and erect, the commoners looked uneasy, cowed by the Queen.
"Is this the past I'm seeing? The present?"
"Even in that world," the caterpillar said, "where no one knew you were a princess, you were to marry royalty. It seems that destiny will not let you deny who you are."
"I don't mean to deny it, Mr. Caterpillar."
The caterpillar frowned, puffing at his hookah.
"Call me Blue."
"All right. I don't want to deny it, Blue. It's just that my time away from Wonderland has confused me. I've been through so much, and all I do is run from those more powerful than myself, which doesn't strike me as being, well, as very queenly."
Blue said, and in the cloud of smoke he exhaled from his caterpillar lungs appeared the words,
"It is sometimes braver to run." "By running, you live to face further uncertainty and trouble," he explained.
it would be much easier for you to give up. You should not doubt your courage, Alice Hart. She who runs from her enemies until she has the strength to do otherwise is both brave and wise.
Funny that it should feel like cowardice. You know why I'm here?
You seek the Looking Glass Maze, as your mother did before you.
Alice said nothing, remembering the surprise of seeing her mother engage so readily in combat.
She must have stood before Blue just as I am now.
Indeed. And like then, the future of the Queendom had been threatened by Red. Blue seemed to know what she was thinking.
Alice Hart, your mother was a warrior queen, as you discovered the hard way. She passed through the maze to assume the throne and to make the most of what she innately possessed. But her strength could only carry her so far. Red was always the stronger of the two. But you, Alice Hart, have the strength of generations in your blood. Successfully navigate the maze, and you will discover this for yourself.
And if I'm unsuccessful?
Blue ignored the question.
Everything you have experienced up until now has had to be, if you are to become the strongest queen Wonderland has ever known. It has been necessary to forge in you the wise and judicious temperament that will guide you as protector of the heart crystal. Hatter Madigan will lead you to one who knows where to find the maze. Look for a puzzle shop. You will know the key to the maze when you see it, but you will have to return to Wondertropolis.
Blue formed an O with his lips and exhaled a thick stream of smoke directly at the princess. When Alice awoke, she was alone. She walked back through the mushrooms to Dodge and the others. The Caterpillar Council sat coiled on their mushrooms, smoking contentedly. Their expressions did not change at the sight of Alice, but the Elysians looked at her, expectant.
"It's back in Wondertropolis," she said.
There were groans all around.
"That's like entering the Jabberwocky's lair," fretted Bibwit, "or stirring up the Seeker's Nest, or..."
The green caterpillar puffed a cloud of smoke at the royal tutor. The smoke enveloped him, and his expression slackened, relaxed.
"Oh, well," he grinned, dreamy. "I suppose we must do what we must do."
"Where in Wondertropolis?" Dodge asked.
"I was told only that Hatter can take us to someone who will know."
The others turned to the milliner, but even he, who was able to maintain his composure in battles that would have sent most Wonderlanders running for their mother's skirts, was a little exasperated by this.
"Me? How can I know anyone? I've hardly been in Wondertropolis in 13 years. The people I knew are all dead."
Bibwit, still feeling the effects of the caterpillar's smoke, put a hand on Hatter's shoulder.
"Relax, my good fellow. The Oracle wouldn't say it just to hear himself talk. There's got to be a reason. Relax and think."
So Hatter thought. What would he have done 13 years ago? To whom would he have turned for help? Where would he have gone?
"There is one place," he said finally. "I don't know if it still exists, but I used to go there whenever official sources didn't yield the information I needed."
"Well then, that's where we'll go,"
General Doppelganger said.
"Let's go already," fumed Dodge.
He didn't much care if they stirred up the Seeker's Nest. On the contrary, he rather welcomed it.
Chapter 46.
It was a long, exhausting journey, without the ease of travel once afforded by the Crystal Continuum. Not wanting to risk further encounters with Jabberwocky, the Elysians skirted the volcanic plains, and luckily, though strangely, considering Red's usual aggression, their trek was uneventful. They hadn't seen a single glass eye or card soldier, just the occasional flock of seekers circling high overhead. They stood gathered at the base of an abandoned building, gazing out at a dingy Wondertropolis alley.
"Where is it?"
General Doppelganger asked.
"There."
Hatter pointed as two Wonderlanders tripped up the front steps of a basement tavern and stumbled into the alley, drunk.
"That's the place?"
General Doppelganger asked.
"It looks more than a bit unsavory."
"It's the only place I know," Hatter said.
He cast a studious eye over his confederates. Bibwit in his scholar's robe, the General, Dodge and Alice in their Elysian uniforms. No amount of camouflage could hide the fact that they were not average Wonderlanders. Still, they didn't have to bring unnecessary attention to themselves by flaunting their rebel colours. So Hatter folded his top hat into a stack of deadly blades and placed it in his inside coat pocket. He removed his coat and draped it over his arm.
"Ready?"
he asked. Alice nodded, conjured hooded cloaks for herself and the others, and the Elysians crossed the alley and entered the tavern. They paused in the doorway to let their eyes adjust to the gloom, giving the bartender and a toothless old smuggler at the counter an opportunity to size them up. The rest of the patrons were too absorbed in their drink to notice the newcomers, slumped half-conscious on their tattered barstools, or passed out altogether.
"We don't have to put ourselves on display, do we?" Dodge said. "Let's sit down."
They had hardly settled around the nearest table when the bartender jerked his head toward a corner of the tavern, and out of the vacuous dark stepped a girl wearing a Homburg hat and a long overcoat, not unlike Hatter's. She approached the Elysians to take their order.
"The shy girl I saw at camp, who brought tea when I had my first talk with Bibwit."
"You?"
Bibwit said, surprised.
"Me,"
the girl confirmed.
"But how did... I don't..."
It was the first time any of them had seen Bibwit Hare at a loss for words.
"My child," he said, recovering himself. "I don't know how you survived the raid on our camp, and of course it's pleasing to discover you, as it would be pleasing to find any of us alive. But what are you doing here? You're too young to be working in a place like this."
"I'm 13. Old enough, I think. And lucky to be working at all."
Alice glanced at Dodge, and the questioning, slightly perturbed expression on his face told her that they were thinking the same thing.
"Is this who we're supposed to meet? It must be. It's too much of a coincidence." But the girl was so young. Not at all what Alice had been expecting.
"How well do you know the city?"
General Doppelganger asked. The girl shrugged.
"Better than most."
Hatter caught sight of a vein in the shape of an H below her left ear. His face hardened.
"She's a Harfer. Civilian and millinery spawn. Not to be trusted."
"Hatter,"
Bibwit began.
"I don't need your trust," the girl said. "I serve the princess, if she'll let me."
With a bow too subtle for those around them to notice, she directly addressed Alice for the first time.
"Homburg Molly at your service, princess."
Alice dipped her head in response.
"We are looking for a certain puzzle shop. Do you know of it?"
"I think I do."
"How can we be sure you won't lead us into a trap?"
The question came from Hatter.
"You can't."
"Hatter, I don't think we need fear the girl," said Bibwit Hare. "And judging by the looks we're getting from the other patrons, we could use a friend in this place."
The longer the Elysians remained in the tavern, the more the regulars woke from their alcohol dreams and squinted menacingly at them. Elysians were not welcome, The toothless smuggler heaved himself away from the bar and hurried out, glaring at them.
"I wonder where he could be going," Dodge said, sarcastic.
"If you're afraid," Molly said to Hatter, "you can stay here."
"Afraid?"
"It happens to everyone."
"Keep it lively, you,"
the bartender shouted.
"You better order something," Molly said. "Bring us whatever will keep you out of trouble," Bibwit said.
Molly went to fetch the order and received an earful of abuse from the bartender for her so-called laziness, he filling 5 cracked mugs with frothy, steaming brew all the while. Bibwit shook his head.
"What sort of a world is it when a youngster must become a barmaid in a place like this to survive?"
"She's a halfer," Hatter repeated, as if the fact in itself was enough to ward them off the girl.
We had halfers at the Elysian headquarters, Hatter," said General Doppelganger. "After the millinery went down, several members lived with us for a time. Many halfers were born under our care. They're not as disloyal as you suppose."
"Their only duty is to their own self-interest."
"She says she knows the puzzle shop," Alice said, and the table fell silent.
"She's the only one the caterpillar could have meant. Look around. There is no one else."
"Assuming this is the place the caterpillar meant for us to be," Dodge said. But Alice had made up her mind. This was the place. Homburg Molly was the one.
"It is," she said.
Molly returned with their drinks and began setting them on the table.
"You see that poster over there, Princess? The one for Red's Hotel and Casino?"
"Yes."
"It's a false wall. Behind it is a way out. We use it whenever we're raided. The cut is already on its way."
"Thanks to our friend with no teeth," Dodge said. Indeed, a division of the cut was at that moment rounding the corner into the alley, led by the toothless smuggler. The unmistakable rasping of the card soldiers' marching, steel-like legs echoed off the buildings. By the time it was heard inside the tavern, it was almost too late. The cut burst in, and the suddenly sober patrons overturned tables and trampled one another in their efforts to flee. Fighting broke out. Dodge, Bibwit, General Doppelganger and Hatter formed a circle around Alice, the first 3 with their swords drawn, Hatter with his wrist blades spinning. Homburg Molly steered them through the brawling soldiers and patrons, ducking to avoid the reach of pummeling fists, her Homburg flattened into a razor-edged disc to shield her from the soldiers' swords.
Dink, clank, pong!
In close formation, the 13-year-old guided the Elysians to the false wall, down a dank tunnel, and safely outside. The street was quiet, no hint of the violence from which they had just escaped. It could have been an ordinary night in Wondertropolis. Molly kept walking, calmly continued down the street, knowing exactly where she was going. The Elysians stood watching her until the girl stopped and turned to them.
"Well, come on if you're coming."
Chapter 47. Emerald Drive was one of the oldest streets in the capital. In Genevieve's time and before, it had been a grand thoroughfare of upscale shops and restaurants. But the wealthy and privileged gradually moved elsewhere as the surrounding streets became havens for looter gangs, imagination-stimulant manufacturers, and wonderlanders engaged in other illicit but profitable employment. The squalor had at last reached its fingers into Emerald Drive itself, and the once celebrated promenade was now indistinguishable from the scum-heavy streets around it. At scattered points along the drive's ruined glory, the homeless warmed themselves around pits glowing with fire crystals, their mumbled conversations brought to a pause by the sight of a strange array of wonderlanders approaching a shop that hadn't been open for business in many lunar cycles. "Zizzles and..." was all that remained of the sign that had once declared the shop's wares, its massive front door, through which 2 spirit Danes could have easily passed side by side, was locked. The single front window was covered with dust and revealed nothing. Dodge pounded on the door.
I doubt anyone's in,
General Doppelganger said. Bibwit's ears twitched.
I hear trouble.
Paler than usual, the tutor removed a sword from beneath his robe and gripped it with two hands. It wasn't long before they all heard it. The dark sky turned darker as Red's moon was eclipsed by a screaming swarm of seekers. The homeless Wonderlanders scattered as...
Grinch!
The seekers attacked. Dodge, Alice, Bibwit and the General slashed at the creatures with their swords, while Hatter sent his top hat blades into the thick of them.
Thimp, 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 thimp.
The blades sliced through the flock, wounding and killing several, and returned to him. Molly flicked her own hat flat and used it as both shield and offensive weapon, digging its sharpened edges into the alien creatures when they shot toward her out of the sky with their hungry insect mouths.
Ah!
One of them swiped Dodge on the shoulder, knocking him to the ground and sending his sword clanking out of reach. The seeker circled, was coming in for the kill with its talons drawn, when someone kicked Dodge's sword back to him.
Seek this!
Dodge hissed through clenched jaw, stabbing the beast. He rolled away from the creature as it writhed in its death throes, saw the Rook and White Knight battling alongside him, together with a small platoon of surviving chessmen.
Hope you don't mind us always showing up unannounced like this, the Rook said.
We followed the Seekers, explained the White Knight, next to each other now, standing. Dodge and the Rook whirled, aiming their swords skyward, just in time for an attacking Seeker to impale itself on them and perish with a hideous howl. A division of Red's Cut appeared at the end of Emerald Drive. A few of the Card soldiers were armed with AD-52s, automatic dealers capable of shooting razor-sharp projectiles the size and shape of ordinary playing cards at the rate of 52 per second. Hardly had the soldiers rounded the corner and spotted the Elysians when a four-card let loose with a spray of razor cards.
Incoming!
General Doppelganger shouted. The Elysians dropped face down in the street, all except Alice and Homburg Molly, who flattened themselves against the front of the puzzle shop as the first of the razor cards sliced past. Hatter jumped in front of them, and with his wrist blades activated and his arms moving in a blur, knocked the rest of the razor cards to the ground. Another round of AD-52 fire quickly followed. But this time Alice closed her eyes and tilted her head back, and the deadly cards passed overhead and to either side. The Elysians were in an invisible, protective bubble courtesy of Alice's imagination. Zipping overhead, the razor cards cut into many of the Seekers, the beast's lifeless body is raining down around the Elysians and landing with a splat on the pavement. With Red's Cut closing in, Hatter hurled his top hat blades at the puzzle shop window. Hitting the glass, the blades rotated and cut a hole large enough for Alice to fit through.
Go!
He shouted. General Doppelganger split into Generals Doppel and Ganger, swords held at the ready. Dodge glared at the advancing card soldiers, his words directed at Alice.
We'll keep them busy. You just find the maze.
But there are too many. Even with the chessmen, we're outnumbered.
Homburg Molly tugged at her sleeve.
No choice. No choice but to go.
Before Alice followed Molly into the shop, she imagined the AD-52s plugged up, useless, and could only hope her imagining had been successful, because she didn't wait around to find out. She dived through the window into the shop. As was perhaps appropriate for any shop specializing in the sale of puzzles and games, this one was itself built in the shape of a puzzle. Handcrafted bookshelves were arranged to form a simple maze. Alice and Homburg Molly ran up and down the narrow passages, but found nothing. Every shelf was bare. They began toppling bookcases, opening every cabinet, trapdoor and dummy window they came across.
What are we looking for?
Molly yelled. Alice could barely hear her over the battle noise from outside.
I don't know.
But then, a bluish twinkle, a wink of coloured light, caught her eye. She looked up and saw it. On the edge of the tallest bookcase in the shop, a
a glowing crystal cube. Up there. I'll get it.
Molly didn't climb more than halfway up the bookcase before it tilted, started to fall. She jumped to the ground, scurrying out of harm's way, but the crystal cube was in the air, falling hard and fast.
No!
Alice screamed. The princess leaped, arms outstretched, as the bookcase crashed to the ground and splintered apart. But she'd caught it. The crystal cube was safe. Alice turned it over in her hands, looking for a clue as to how it worked.
What am I supposed to...
Kaborchk!
The shop door imploded, and still holding on to the radiant cube, Alice fell back, through a looking glass painted to appear like part of a wall. The fighting had spilled into the shop. But floating weightless inside the looking glass, Wonderland's rightful princess saw the battle scene freeze, stopped in time. There was Dodge, with his sword raised, attacking a two-card. There was Hatter in mid-air, the saber blades of his belt open to fight three-card soldiers at once, a pair of fours and a two. There were the generals come to help Bibwit, who had somehow lost hold of his sword. And there was Homburg Molly, staring wide-eyed at the spot where the princess had fallen through the looking-glass. Alice saw it all as if through a watery film. And despite the mortal threat she and the Elysians were facing, despite the uncertainty of everything, she felt almost serene as she drifted down into the looking-glass maze. Chapter 48. She landed gently on her feet, in the middle of what appeared to be a prison. A looking-glass prison. On every side of her were looking-glasses as tall as forever, and no matter what direction she turned, she saw her reflection infinitely repeating into the mirrored distance.
"This is a maze,"
she said aloud. But instead of hearing just her voice, she heard a chorus of voices, all of them hers. Something was wrong, besides that she wasn't in a maze.
"I must have found the wrong key, but..."
"Odd. That looks like me, and yet it doesn't." The reflection directly in front of Alice was off somehow, inexact. She reached out toward the looking-glass and...
Ah!
The reflection grabbed her and pulled her into it.
"We have to hurry," the reflection said. "Lots to do and many people to see. So little time."
"But..."
Alice couldn't think what to say. The reflection wouldn't let go of her wrist and pulled her at a fast clip past looking-glass halls that branched and snaked into the distance, past mirrored alcoves and dead ends. Even the floor was made of looking-glass. Being led first one way and then another, Alice felt sure her reflection was taking her this complex route only to confuse her.
"Better not have to find my way back."
Because there was no chance of that. Alice had lost all sense of direction. The reflection brought her to a stop in what appeared to be a rest area, a mirrored room, wider than the corridors along which they'd passed.
"Wait here," the reflection said. "Someone will be with you shortly."
"Don't leave me."
But Alice was already alone. Or was she? Her likeness looked back at her from every surface.
"Hello,"
she said, and again a chorus of voices said it with her, the voices of her reflections. She lifted her hand toward the one closest to her, to take hold of it, but her fingers couldn't penetrate the looking-glass and stubbed themselves against its cold quicksilver surface.
Maybe I was supposed to follow her.
But Alice could no longer be sure in which direction the reflection had gone.
"Imagine a way out. That must be what I'm supposed to do. It's a test."
Alice gathered herself tight for the effort her imaginings required. But between the flicker of her eyelids, she saw someone approaching from the distance of a looking-glass. Closer and closer the person came,
and even before Alice could make out the woman's face, she recognized the clothes.
Mother!
She and her reflections gasped. Genevieve was dressed as her daughter had last seen her, but without the crown. She came right up to the other side of the looking-glass.
Alice,
Genevieve said, and the wistful, proud smile that formed on the dead queen's face caused tears to well up in her daughter's eyes.
She's become as beautiful as I imagined, said a man's voice.
Alice turned to see her father, Nolan, beaming at her from one of the looking-glasses in place of her reflection.
Dad!
She said, running to embrace him, wanting to feel the touch of her long-gone father. I don't care about any maze, or about Red, or the heart crystal. I want us all to be back together again. I want my family back. I want my family back.
But Alice couldn't pass through the looking-glass.
What is this?
She cried.
Where are you?
We're in you, dear, Nolan said.
Genevieve gave a little sigh.
If we are successful against Red, no one can say that our success has been without sacrifice. But I sometimes wonder if it has required too much of us.
Of all involved who fight for white imagination, said Nolan.
Yes, of course, said Genevieve. The path to a victory of this magnitude is doomed to be littered with defeats and failures.
With a soft look of sympathy, Nolan walked from one looking-glass to another to stand next to his wife. He put his arm around her and kissed her on the forehead, which seemed to raise her spirits.
Alice, Genevieve said, it is good that you have taken it upon yourself to exercise your imagination. You are well on your way to reaching your potential of imaginative power and control. But all you have experienced and discovered about yourself is not enough. Not yet.
Look at her, Nolan chuckled. She's an adult. She doesn't need her parents nagging her. Alice, my sweet, have half as much faith in yourself as others have in you, and you'll be fine.
The royal couple turned and began walking off into the distance of the looking-glass.
Wait!
Alice shouted.
Don't go!
But Genevieve and Nolan kept walking.
Wait! Will I ever see you again?
They stopped, apparently surprised by the question.
Again and again and again, said Nolan. If you know where to look for us, said Genevieve.
Then they were gone, and Alice's reflection once again occupied the glass. All strength left the princess. She fell to her knees and buried her face in her hands. She would never get over the sudden, violent loss of her parents, never be able to accept the absence their deaths had left behind.
How can I? How could anyone?
Her sobs were magnified tenfold as her reflections cried with her. The worst of it had passed. All that was left of Alice's swell of unhappiness, the occasional hiccup of a sob, or a sudden intake of breath. Someone touched her shoulder.
Tag, you're it!
Alice lifted her head and saw a little girl.
Is that?
She brushed the hair out of her face and wiped her eyes to be sure.
She looks exactly like me.
It was Alice Hart, age 7, wearing her birthday dress.
You want me to chase you?
Alice asked. The girl clicked her tongue, annoyed.
Haven't you ever played tag before? Yes, but not in some time.
The princess got to her feet. It wasn't every day that you met up with your younger self. Who knew where it might lead?
Okay, she said. You'd better run then.
With a cry of pleasure, the girl sprinted down the corridor. Alice chased after her,
and corridor after corridor of the looking-glass maze was briefly visited by the running pair. As much as Alice had wallowed in the depths of her sorrow moments before, she now entered into the buoyant pleasure of the chase, laughing with each near tagging of her younger self. She approached a corner in the maze, and the younger Alice jumped out from behind it, teasing the princess with her capture.
Ha!
They both laughed so hard that it became difficult to run, and when the girl stopped to catch her breath, Alice hurried up and took hold of her.
I've got you now,
she said, tickling the girl.
No, don't! Stop! Stop!
The younger Alice squealed in delight, because of course the princess knew where she was most ticklish. But the girl suddenly became serious, pushed Alice's hands away, and looked off at something. Alice turned to see what it was. A diamond-encrusted scepter, topped with a white crystal heart at the far end of a wide corridor.
Do you think you can get the scepter?
The girl asked. It looked easy. Alice only had to walk down the corridor and take it.
Why not?
The corridor walls consisted of looking-glass panels that lined up perfectly, facing each other. Alice stepped between the first pair, and her reflection swirled and swirled to form a sort of vortex, and then she was no longer in the looking-glass maze. She stood in a featureless nothing, with a tornado of images whipping around her, the words and gestures of the people in them wounding as much as any made by beings of flesh and blood.
Off with her head! Off with her head!
Red swooped toward the princess. Alice jumped out of the way, her heart thumping, when... There was Dodge Anders, as a boy, wearing his guardsman uniform and receiving a lesson in the etiquette of palace guardsmen from Sir Justice. But like Red before them, they too vanished. Quigley Gaffer stood before her now, pointing and laughing in her face as if she were the most ridiculous creature he'd ever seen.
Stop it, she said.
But Quigley was joined by the rest of the London orphans, Charlie, Andrew, Otis, Francine, Esther and Margaret, as well as some of the wardens she'd known at the Charing Cross Foundling Hospital.
Stop it!
She screamed. Their laughter continued to echo in her ears, even after they'd faded from sight, and she was gazing upon a silent but confusing scene. She and Prince Leopold surrounded by what appeared to be their four children, picnicking in the everlasting forest with Dean and Mrs. Little. Two of the children were infants, but they had the faces of Genevieve and Nolan. Alice wanted to call out to her family, but she couldn't get her voice to work. The cat stood over her oblivious, picnicking family, licking blood off its paws, until a single drop fell to the ground and became a roiling, bloody sea in which her family was drowning. The Elysians were in it too, Dodge, Bibwit, Hatter, General Doppelganger, the chessmen. All were drowning. But then the sea drained out through an open door, carrying her friends and loved ones with it. Above the door was an illuminated exit sign, and next to it stood the walrus butler.
Oh my, oh dear, said the walrus. It's only going to get worse, Princess. You don't have to put yourself through this. It's not necessary. Please, I beg you to leave while you still can.
With his left flipper, he urged her to use the exit. But Alice knew better. The maze had shown her these things to soften her up, to make her more vulnerable for whatever she might face next. She was determined to face it. She turned her back on the walrus, lifted her foot to step forward into the nothingness before her, and found herself back in the looking-glass maze, in the corridor leading to the scepter. She had made it past the first pair of looking-glass panels. She moved forward to stand between the next pair of looking-glasses, but no sooner had she done so than the maze melted away, and she found herself in the south dining room of Hart Palace, the scene of Red's invasion.
I don't need to see this, she said.
Everyone in the room was staring at the kitten that had begun to morph into the cat as...
No!
Alice cried.
Crawbush!
An explosion blew the doors apart, and Red and her rogue soldiers spilled into the room. Alice was forced to relive the horror of that ungodly hour, to experience all over again Sir Justice's murder and the destruction of her home, her own near death at Red's hands. Once was too much. No one should have to experience such horribleness. She watched with steadily rising anger as her 7-year-old self and Hatter jumped into the palace's emergency portal. That wrenching, final separation from her mother. And Genevieve turned to face her sister alone. Then she saw what she had never seen before. Her mother, bound by Red's carnivorous roses, Red cutting off Genevieve's head with a single swing of the scarlet energy bolt. She ran at Red, fury in her heart. But the way to Red became long, and suddenly the 23-year-old Dodge was running alongside her, saying in a voice tight with rage, "Hate makes you strong. Forget restoring white imagination to power and Wonderland to its past glory. There's no justice except the justice of revenge. The only way to defeat Red is to embrace your anger." The cat jumped in front of them, and Dodge plunged his sword into the beast again and again. But he seemed no less angry for it, as if his anger would remain, no matter how many times he killed Red's vicious henchmen. Alice was almost within striking distance of Red, when her mother's head, lying in a corner where it had rolled, opened its eyes and spoke. "Black imagination feeds on anger, Alice. Give in to your anger, and you merely become a pawn of black imagination, which may triumph for a time, but never for eternity."
"But look at what happened to you,"
Alice said.
"Yes, look at me. It should tell you a lot that I'm the one saying this."
But the pressure of hate in Alice's skull was too great.
"It tells me that you were weak, and that's why you lost,"
she screamed, snatching Red's scepter and cutting off her aunt's head with a single swing, just as she had killed Genevieve. Red and the roses faded into the floor, and Alice discovered herself standing in a circular room with walls of telescopic glass that allowed her to see the chessboard desert and Wondertropolis in their entirety. Bibwit rushed into the room with an open book in his hands, reading from it with great urgency, wanting her to understand.
"Fleglubra messing pla gri bono plan," the tutor read. "Taik grsplinaf rosh ingo."
"Bibwit?"
"Zixwaquit. Surgle gurgle. Fgurgle gurgle."
The tutor continued spouting gibberish, growing more and more agitated with Alice's lack of understanding, which was when she glimpsed herself in a looking-glass. Instead of her usual features, she saw Red looking back at her. She had become Red!
"No!"
She smashed the glass, and her entire surroundings, the circular room, the nonsensical Bibwit, showered down around her in fragments, leaving her standing before the entrance glass in the maze. On the other side of the glass, the clash between Elysians and Red soldiers was stopped in time.
"Why am I here? What does this mean?"
A stream of smoke crossed her vision. She turned and saw the blue caterpillar puffing at his hookah.
"It means you failed, Princess."
"I
can't fail. The maze is intended for me."
"But..."
"You were unable to navigate the maze. It is unfortunate for all of us, but nothing can be done. You must leave through the glass and re-enter the battle."
Failure's not an option. She would rather have been anywhere else, but she couldn't leave yet. Not as a failure.
Unacceptable, she said. I don't accept it.
And before Blue could blow smoke into her face, she ran deep into the maze. She was quickly lost, but all was not lost as long as she remained here. She could still succeed. She would succeed. Otherwise, what would become of... A figure strode into the corridor up ahead.
Hatter!
Oh, she was glad to see him. But the milliner said nothing, raised a sword and rushed at her.
Wait! What are you...
She had to do something quick. She imagined a sword in her hand. And almost before she realized it, she and Hatter were fighting. He the aggressor, she surprising herself with a defense that relied on mirroring his moves. Hatter at last lowered his weapon and stepped away, approving.
Good.
So he was assessing her. Alice understood, developing her warrior skills. Or rather, he was training her imagination in the service of her warrior skills. Still, when a second Hatter Madigan appeared, I have to fight two of them? In addition to the sword, Alice armed herself with a hand of Timon. She parried with the two Hatters. Clank! Schwink! Ding! Schlank! Whenever one of them made a move she had never seen before, she quickly appropriated it, imagined it as part of her own repertoire. But merely conjuring herself into a better swordswoman wasn't going to be good enough. She had to employ her imagination in other ways, because a third and fourth Hatter appeared, then a fifth and a sixth. Clashing weapons with one Hatter, she imagined that the others felt it. But this proved insufficient as more Hatters stepped forward, so she conjured her numberless reflections to her aid. They jumped from their looking glasses, swords in hand, and for every Hatter Madigan there was now an Alice Hart to battle him.
Excellent,
one of the Hatters said, and at his signal the milliners gave up their swords and activated their wrist blades, employed their boomeranging top hats. Alice imagined razor cards shooting from the sleeves of her uniform, but the Hatters battered them down easily enough. Never had she wielded her imaginative powers so precisely, so intensely, or for so long a time.
Getting tired. Not sure how much longer I can...
Sensing her own defeat, she shot wads of a thick gummy substance from the sleeves of her uniform. The wads hit the Hatter's weapons and stopped up their rotary workings, and in the same instant, Alice took a deep breath and exhaled, causing such a wind that the Hatters were blown off their feet, lay sprawled on the floor throughout the combat arena. The fighting was over. Alice was alone among the defeated Hatters, her reflections back in their looking glasses.
Control and power aren't everything, one of the Hatters said. Allow yourself to be the agent by which a cause greater than any single individual triumphs. Then, perhaps, you'll be worthy of the Heart Crystal.
The Hatters picked themselves up, bowed, and backed away down the maze's various corridors. After a short rest, Alice felt infused with power and health, better than she had before running into the Hatters.
Better than I have felt in a long, long time. Maybe ever.
It was a lot like she used to feel before her seventh birthday, when she thought herself capable of anything, and the world was a beautiful place.
What was that?
A creaking sound, like something being hoisted. And voices.
Off to the left? Yes, there they are again.
She followed the sounds, and coming to the end of a shallow...
agent by which a cause greater than...
fast... the White Knight and the Rook, kneeling with their hands fastened behind them, their heads locked in an enormous guillotine. Queen Red and the Cat were standing by the lever that would drop the blade, waiting for her.
But I killed you!
Alice said.
Did you?
Red turned to the Cat.
Why wasn't I informed?
The Cat shrugged.
Is this real or a figment? Can't be real since she's not dead. So there's no danger to anyone if I walk away.
Just walk away. But Alice couldn't. The sight of the captured Elysians kept her rooted to the spot. She couldn't chance it, however much reality the scene might contain. Red's apparent multiple lives notwithstanding, who could be sure that if one died in the maze, he or she would still be alive on the outside?
"I'll kill you again if I have to,"
Alice said, stepping forward.
"Perhaps," said Red. "But that won't save your friends."
Alice again imagined wads of the sticky substance shooting from her sleeves, gumming up the guillotine's works and keeping its blade from falling. Nothing. She imagined the blade turning into water and splashing down on the Elysians' heads. Nothing. Red laughed.
"The lovely thing about being here," she said, gesturing at the maze, "is that I'm able to imagine your imagination powerless." "Ah, if only that were the case on the outside. But enough chit-chat. If you're going to die, which you are, I'm sure you'd like to get it over with. These people are no threat to me without you. There is only one way you can save them. Give yourself up. You might as well. I'll eventually kill you anyway. Then you and your friends will be dead. However, to save myself some trouble, I'm giving you a choice."
But how could Alice be sure that if she sacrificed herself, Red would allow her friends to live, let alone live freely? Wasn't it more likely that once Alice was dead, Red would kill the Elysians because she could? But what if, because of some unknown leniency in Red, she did allow them to live? They had fought on behalf of White Imagination for 13 years without Alice. If, by sacrificing herself, she could secure for them the promise of longer lives, didn't duty demand her sacrifice? They might yet manage to escape. Hatter might find a way. The spirit of White Imagination would live with them. It lived only so long as they did. Thinking it the final act in her short, troubled life, Princess Alice Hart knelt down before her aunt.
"Here's to my legacy," Red said, lifting her scepter.
But the moment its cold blade touched the tender back of Alice's neck,
zomp!
The scene vanished, and the princess stood directly in front of the White Heart scepter. She reached for it, and as her fingers closed around the scepter's shaft, she was transported by the magic of the maze back into the puzzle shop, amid the chaos of battle once again raging between the Elysians and Red's soldiers.